Welcome to Truth Talk with Myron.
Welcome to Truth Talk. Today we have with us Professor Clower from the University of North Texas. Good morning, sir. Glad to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Myron.
And today we're going to be discussing wealth in Washington. And Professor Clower, for our guests who are not familiar with you, would you give us a little bit of background about your position, sir?
Oh, sure. I'm an associate professor in the economics department at the University of North Texas, and I run a research center called the Center for Economic Development and Research. Our center works with communities to do economic development strategic planning, to look and help them find ways to better grow their economies, create jobs for their residents, and we work on a variety of issues, including labor issues, transportation issues, doing public policy analysis.
Okay, sounds good. Well, the first thing to get to the subject matter here, we want to touch base on the wealth in Washington, and it's quite interesting with the way that the economy is and the way things are going in this country, of how much wealth or the boom that's in Washington, D.C. and the counties around it. And I want to ask you, how is wealth created in that geographical area that doesn't produce or create anything that the public wants?
Well, I think I would differ with you a little bit on two elements, but let's take them in pieces. The
okay.
wealth is created in D.C. Through several different ways. So we will just set aside corporations that are there, you know, particularly if you think the entire Netflix that is out toward Dulles Airport, where you have a lot of technology firms. Obviously, there are a lot of defense contractors who are doing business with the government, and there are many other regular businesses that are located in that area that create jobs and, of course, are contributing to wealth. But to speak directly to the idea of what wealth is created in dealing with the government, it comes from multiple sources. First of all, of course, are those businesses that really their biggest client in one way or another is the federal government. I mean, we think about the entire military defense complex. So, you know, whether it's Lockheed, General Dynamics, E-Systems, L3, all these different companies whose largest client base is the federal government, and particularly the Department of Defense. So that's part of the national budget, and of course those folks that are working there, you know, many of them are executives and many of them are well paid. You also, of course, because Washington is the seat of power, it is where things are, where you try to exert influence, and the attorneys and the lobbyists that represent interest, and whether that interest be all the way from a group who represents small farmers out in the Midwest, to folks that are trying to do things about attracting or spelling out the need for additional federal funding in the colonias of the border of Texas, or folks that have other agendas are trying to exert their influence, and those people that are successful at exerting influence certainly usually get pretty high salaries.
Okay. So, I mean, it's like saying, I guess, that, you know, the federal government employs about 245,000 people, correct?
Oh, give or take, yeah, I don't know the exact figure, but that sounds about right.
Okay, and just on average, their compensation is about $120,000. In addition to that, you know, to the president and vice president, there are only about 435 members of Congress, and I guess about 100 senators. So that's like 244,000 other people being paid very well by taxpayers. Would you say that's about right?
Oh, sure. That's probably about right. But, you know, consider what they are doing. If we look at the federal budget overall, and this is where we get into, you know, are they producing a product we want? Well,
right.
Over half of the federal budget is in what we would call the big entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So I think if we talk to folks, you know, generally across the country, if you say that you're going to propose that we eliminate Social Security as a backstop, I think you'd find many folks are probably not really in favor of that. And then we have another big hunk of the budget, say something in order of close to $800 billion a year is spent on defense. And that spending actually happens, you know, all around the world, of course, wherever we have troops are, but, you know, concentrations there in the Pentagon. So when we start breaking it down, then you think about all those other agencies, the cabinet agencies, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Commerce, all of these different departments, their part of their budget is less than 20% of our total spending.
Right.
Now,
right.
You know, so we get into that sense that, okay, in some respects, there is, we say, you know, that maybe they're creating services or goods that we don't want, but the people that are spelling out what we need to be doing, we're the ones electing them.
Right, I understand that, but it's like when you talk about boom towns in history, historically, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, say, like, just west of us, here, you know, there's Abilene. Well, Abilene was a boom town at one time, but there was cattle. They were producing something from cattle and whatnot. And mm-hmm. there have been other boom towns in the nation have actually produced a good or service or something. Where in the counties in D.C., they don't produce anything. It's just, you know, like you said, they're elected to certain positions, but they've made a career out of politics, so to speak, when it wasn't really meant to be that way. Am I correct? I mean, the point was to go in, serve, do your term, get out, and allow somebody else to serve their term. Am I wrong about that? But these guys...
Well, you know, the concept, though, you know, it's hard to say exactly when that changed in practice, but the concept was to have citizen legislators.
Okay.
You know, folks that would serve and would serve for a time and then go back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and maybe this is where part of the problem has come in terms of do we feel that the Congress, the people in Congress, are representing our interests the way they should, particularly mm-hmm. our financial interests. Well, you know, part of the answer to that one is, well, we keep electing the same people largely to go back to Congress. I mean, you look at the, you know, some of these folks that have been in their, you know, in position for 15 years, 20 years, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reminded of Einstein's definition of insanity. You know, if you do the same thing over and over again, why should you expect a different result?
Right, right. That's a good point. It's like I was saying, in history, when those boom towns in history offered us something, they offered something to build upon. And I guess what I'm saying is that in D.C., they offer nothing but, I guess you could say, connections to power and patronage, right? So if they're offering power and patronage, it's kind of like they've become a permanent political class, if you want to put Einstein's theory there, and it's invested in growth of government so that they can grow their personal portfolios, right?
Well, I mean, there's two groups of folks that we're talking about here. You have the elected officials, and then you
mm-hmm.
have the folks that work in the bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for folks in your audience that have never seen it, there is a brilliant British comedy that's been off the air for many, many years. It was from the late 70s, early 80s, called Yes, Minister. And it was very much centered on the foibles of the bureaucracy, if you
okay.
will. They call them permanent secretaries and people like that. In other words, it's the bureaucratic staff. And amazingly, that even though that show is 30 years old now, so much of it still rings true. And, you know, and they kind of poke fun in a very British way about, you know, the way about their own institutions of government. And so what we've seen develop over time, of course, is a massive expansion in the role of government from the time of the founding fathers until current. And much of that has been done at the citizens' behest.
Okay.
You think about it, and let's take an example now that the poor folks up there in the Northeast that got hit by Hurricane Sandy, and then of mm-hmm. course now are just getting absolutely dumped on with massive snowfalls. I mean, but when we see a natural disaster now, and let's
mm-hmm.
even go back to Katrina and all, that we think that this is the federal government's job to come in and fix, not only fix the problem that caused it, but to restore people, to make them whole after this disaster. Now, that's a relatively recent phenomenon. It wasn't until the 1950s that we thought about such things. And indeed, if you go back to the late 19th century, there was a case where Texas had applied for federal assistance based on a drought, and the sitting president at the time, I'm going to get that wrong about exactly which president, but it is the late 19th century, and basically the statement was, there is nothing in the Constitution that provides for the federal government to bail a state out or its citizens out for the effects of a disaster.
Okay.
And yet now it very much is the expectation.
Right.
So now that's just one small example. During the 1930s, we created a program, and I'm going to be very clear in my language. We created a program that taxes existing workers to pay for retirement benefits and to care for elderly people.
Okay.
And that was Social Security. And I mean, this was not a pension plan. This was a tax on current workers to take care of folks that were retired and, of course, disabled.
Okay.
So this was something that you know, we elected folks that put that system into place. During the 1960s, we as a country, and of course this was Lyndon Johnson's Great Society's programs, but you know, we decided that we wanted to do more to help those that have trouble caring for themselves.
Okay.
So over time, we just have built these things up, and we've created expectations.
Okay.
Our next guest is with us.
Okay. I think we're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back.
On Thursday in Portland, Oregon, a 21-year-old Somali American who had talked about the glories of, quote, jihad, was convicted of federal terrorism charges. His lawyers claimed that he'd been led to act, that is, entrapped by the FBI. That argument failed this week, but it's become an increasingly common refrain. Journalist Trevor Aronson has researched 158 cases of accused terrorists apprehended through FBI stings. In his new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, he finds that since 9/11, the U.S. government is responsible for, quote, hatching and financing more terrorist plots in the United States than any other group.
There are 15,000 registered informants working for the FBI today, which is an unprecedented number. There are informants in every community large enough to support a mosque. Some work for the FBI for money. You can make $100,000 or more per case. In other cases, the informants are coerced into cooperating through the fear of deportation or through FBI saying, if you work with us, we'll make this criminal charge go away.
There's a piece in Mother Jones magazine excerpting your book, The Terror Factory, that begins with a guy who wants to create mayhem but hasn't the wherewithal.
Sure. That was the case of a man named Kwasi Nafis. Nafis was a Bangladeshi student here in the U.S. He had just arrived in January of 2012, and he meets an informant and explains to him that he's interested in committing an act of terrorism. The informant introduces him to an undercover agent posing as an Al-Qaeda operative, and Nafis explains that he wants to strike at the heart of the American capitalist system and then says, well, no, maybe we should bomb the New York Federal Reserve building. And the FBI brings in the chemicals they need for this bomb that they'll load up in a van that is also provided by the FBI. And they get Nafis to then drive the van with the undercover agent in front of the Federal Reserve building of New York. He and the FBI agent walk to a hotel room, and he dials on a cell phone, expecting it to blow up and destroy the Federal Reserve building, kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people in and around New York. Of course, that never happens. FBI agents rush in and arrest him.
All right. At this time, we're back, and we want to welcome with us Professor Hendrick. Professor Hendrick, thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon. How are you?
We're fine. We have with us Professor Clower and Professor Hendrick. Professor Hendrick, give us a little bit of background about your expertise, sir.
Well, I'm a professor at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and I regularly teach both international economics as well as economic growth and development. So my specific expertise is to look to see how economies grow or don't grow and how they change structurally during that general growth process that economies go through.
Okay, very good. As I was speaking with Professor Clower there, we were talking about the wealth in Washington. And this is a question I want to direct to both of you. And Professor Hendrick, I'll start with you on this. With the economic climate, you know, with Washington, quote-unquote, the counties around Washington, D.C., being kind of considered a boom town, if you will. And I asked the question previously to Professor Clower of how can so much wealth be created in their area that doesn't produce or create anything that the public wants? What I wanted to ask you, though, more specifically, is what type of economic development is that? Or is it even economic development?
Well, it is, you know, part of what's happening in our system. So in that sense, it's part of economic change. And if you want to define development very generally as just gradual economic change, that indeed is what is happening. You know, I think we have to look at Washington as a fairly special phenomenon. It is in part quite legitimate in what happens in Washington. That is, it is the seat of our federal government. A modern economy needs a government. We need government to do quite a few things, and we can, you know, discuss forever as to exactly what should government do, but certainly an economy of, you know, our size and of our level of development needs a substantial government to provide a variety of services, essentially. You know, government allows a population to collectively act to perform certain tasks that might not be or wouldn't be performed by individuals. So that's quite a legitimate purpose of government. Washington is the seat of that. So that is the legitimate side of it. Of course, what we see in Washington is quite interesting. When you create a government, you know, government can have a good impact or it can have a bad impact. And what we've seen is essentially that huge government that we have in Washington being captured by special interests. And at that point, we get something that in economics we refer to often as rent-seeking activity. That is, we engage truly in something that is not productive, but rather almost exclusively trying to redistribute the gains in the economy. That is, trying to, in a sense, capture that government structure that we create and bias it in favor of certain groups to the detriment of others. And what we're seeing in Washington with those very high incomes, if it were just a normal government functions being carried out, you know, running our democracy, providing public services, public goods, and so forth, we shouldn't see necessarily any exceptional incomes in Washington. We should see about the same incomes that we see everywhere else in the country. Where do these very high incomes come from? Well, that is because of the tremendous profitability to certain groups to capturing government institutions and using them, you know, biasing the tax system, biasing subsidy payments, biasing government expenditures towards certain sectors, helping the financial industry capture a larger piece of GDP. Those things are highly profitable. So we see a lot of extremely well-paid people who, from their specific perspectives, earn tremendous gains to certain groups, and hence, you know, they're paid large amounts of money. The incredible number of lobbyists that are active in Washington, and that's where that high income largely comes from. It comes from the corruption of the political system as opposed to the normal functions that we should have in our political system.
Okay. Professor Clower, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with Professor Hendricks in many respects, and indeed, you know, as he was speaking, I was kind of thinking a little bit of an analogy where our, you know, perhaps our highest concentrations of wealth outside of the entertainment industry are in New York, you know, from financial sector activities, of course, and then Washington, D.C., and both of them share the characteristic that they kind of have the thing of, send us your money and don't worry about it, we'll take care of it.
Right, okay.
And so, yeah, I mean, this is the issue that Dr. Hendricks brings up about, you know, over time we have had increasing distortions and rules and regulations that are maybe with the best of intent have distorted the market and have created increasing inefficiencies, I should say. Now, there's two things about that. First of all, though, in part, we're still the best economy in the world, so despite the best efforts of government, businesses still manage to find a way to operate efficiently, maybe not as efficiently as they could. The other, though, goes back to, I think, a point that I hope I was clear about earlier, where, you know, if this is not being done correctly, the voters have the power to make changes. But in terms of the way we actually do things, we don't make changes. We send the same people up there for 30 years at a time or 20 years. And, of course, part of the problem that Dr. Hendricks speaks about is built up over time. If you had people that were showing up for 2 years or 4 years and then going home, you wouldn't quite have the opportunity to build up these relationships that turn into a power base that is worth millions of dollars a year to a particular lobbyist.
Okay. Well, one of you explained clearly what economic development is and what economic growth is.
Well, I can address that since that's what I teach almost every day. You know, the economic growth, unfortunately, has simply become a mathematical calculation. That is the change in what we call the gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. That's what economists use. That's what the press uses. And those are the numbers that come out on a regular basis. Did GDP go up or did it go down by how much? A gross domestic product is a very imperfect measurement of human well-being. You know, it's a very partial measurement. It was invented actually back in the 1930s when economists and the government needed a quick measure with which to judge the economy and therefore judge the effects of certain policies. It was a quick and dirty measurement because it only measures market transactions. It does not measure household activity. It puts in no value for leisure and quality of life issues. So again, it's a very partial measure. It's convenient to gather, so we do. But again, it's a very partial measure of the things that actually make life good. And that's generally what we call growth. Development would be best defined as an attempt to come up with a more complete measure of human well-being. That would look at issues such as, again, quality of life, education, human relationship, distribution of income, that is, how is that that income derived from producing output shared in the economy. It would, of course, include things like leisure time, which, you know, GDP, that has no value, it has no money value, so we don't count it. Certainly we enjoy our leisure, it should have value. So development would be an attempt to come up with a more accurate measure of well-being. And again, there's been a lot of interesting research over the last several decades in that regard, bringing in other disciplines, psychology, sociology, such things, again, looking at what makes for a healthy society, what makes people happy. There's, in fact, an interesting literature called Happiness Studies that basically, you know, takes surveys and looks at which countries actually has the people that claim to be happiest and which countries have people least happy. And there's something of a correlation with GDP, but it's a very imperfect one with many, many, many huge exceptions there, making it, again, obvious that, you know, human interaction, dignity, distribution of income, participation in life are very important. And GDP, in which we generally measure growth, just doesn't capture that. So that's, you know, a very quick and dirty definition or two definitions of those two terms.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Clower, can you explain, or better yet, will you explain the economic model of D.C. versus Wall Street? Because aren't there similarities between the two?
Oh, well, yeah, and of course I was being a little flippant earlier, but there are certainly some similarities. But in D.C., of course, you have the government who uses its legal authority to tax us, and then to take that tax money and do, as Professor Hendricks suggested, some things that a large country and a large economy needs, and of course do things like provide for the national defense and safety and security measures, and there's many, many different things that they do, and they're doing it with our money.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Wall Street, I guess you get into almost the thing about this difference of economic growth and economic development, whereas Wall Street, we send money to Wall Street in terms of investing in companies or bonds or other activities, other financial type of instruments, and we are trying to get a return on our investment, a monetary return. We want to have more money coming back than what we send in. And in terms of government, of course, we're not necessarily, though certain groups do, expect to get money back, but what we're thinking more generally is that we are going to have a service performed for us.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of government. So there is a distinct difference of what the outcome would be, although in some respects, you know, I think there are many people who think of Social Security, again, as kind of a pension. They think that, well, I'm sending this money in, and therefore at some point in the future, I'm going to be able to get that money out. It is my money. And mm-hmm. that is just simply not really the case.
Right. Okay. But, isn't it true? Now, I want you guys to correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, Washington basically controls the market, right? And Wall Street just kind of plays as the puppeteers to that market, right?
No, I would disagree entirely with that.
and I have to agree with Professor Hendricks.
Because you have lobbyists, right?
I'm not sure. I like this idea of Wall Street versus D.C. I think the two are quite in cahoots. I think Wall Street,
right,
to a considerable degree, uses Washington, D.C. to its advantage. It has been lobbying for quite a few decades for deregulation, for being given greater freedom, allowed to merge and become larger, to occupy an ever greater portion of our economy, and Washington has gone along with that in exchange for rather significant pressures and monetary payments, and this has been across all administrations. This is certainly not a party thing. This has been, we don't have consensus in Washington. I think as far as letting Wall Street get away with things, there's been a wonderful consensus in Washington, unfortunately. And so I think Wall Street has used Washington to its ends marvelously and very effectively. So I guess I don't agree with the Wall Street versus D.C., quite to the contrary.
Okay. I guess I should have rephrased the question because you proved my point. I guess I just didn't say it in the right way, is that I don't mean that they're against each other. I meant the economic model of Washington versus Wall Street, and what I was trying to get to is that it was similar. They worked together, so to speak. A lot of people blame Wall Street for a lot of things. But Washington knows exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what Washington is doing, and they work together. That's my point. I guess I didn't phrase that
in
the correct way.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I might challenge something in that we have plenty of evidence in the last 10 years or so that Washington may not know exactly what they're doing, and for that matter, may not. Wall Street might not either. Or if they know what they're doing, we've created a backstop system to where they can recklessly pursue unknown risk.
That's been part of the entire deregulation process. Of course, deregulation up to a point, deregulation, as long as we're ahead and doing well, please provide lots of assistance when we screw up. So it's been kind of a mixed bag of this, you know, dereg, stay out of our hair when we're doing well, but please, yes, help us out when things go wrong. So it's been a largely, you know, special interest lobbying in Washington has created a system that allows the financial system to capture an ever larger portion of total income in the country. It's been rather astounding how, you know, the increase of the financial sector in our economy, and there really doesn't, I don't think there's much evidence that that has been terribly beneficial to the economy. You know, certainly if you look at economic performance, we did much better back in the 50s and 60s with a much more regulated financial system with, you know, the competition among banks much greater simply because they were much smaller. Since deregulation, we've had incredible concentration into a very few, a small number of very, very large banks, you know, too large to fail type of institutions that we've had to bail out at a very, very large expense. And so, you know, it's been a system truly very profitable to the financial system, but not necessarily at all beneficial to the economy as a whole. So, again, it's, you know, perhaps it shows up in GDP. In fact, you know, the financial sector does contribute to gross product. But, again, whether this is economic development, I don't think so.
Okay. When we come back from break, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to address how corrupt has Washington, D.C. become. We'll be back in a minute.
He's an example of someone who never had the capacity for terrorism on his own. It was the FBI that provided everything he needed to go from a disgruntled student to a deadly terrorist.
Now, in your book, you point out that after the United States invasion of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda structurally became incapable of mounting a plot such as 9/11 and changed its strategy to enabling lone wolves to pull off terror plots. These guys who the FBI have infiltrated are exactly the kind of lone wolves that Osama bin Laden meant to send out into the world. Why should we not be fearful of them?
In these FBI terrorism stings, we're really finding people on the fringes of society. You know, many are financially desperate. Others are mentally ill. On their own, they never have the capability to commit an act of terrorism. There have been dangerous and deadly lone wolves. You know, if you look at Faisal Shahzad, he delivered a car bomb to Times Square. It was smoking. A street vendor saw it, and fortunately, it didn't go off. The FBI had no knowledge of him. The FBI has had a difficult, if not impossible, time teasing out people who are the real terrorists.
The implication of your book is that it's really all about the press conference. It's all about making us feel like the FBI has our back.
You know, every year the FBI gets $3 billion to fund its counterterrorism program. It's the largest portion of its budget. What the FBI has done very effectively is play the media. When there's an announcement of a sting operation, it's played on the front page as another terrorist plot foiled. But it often takes days and sometimes longer than that before the media realizes, well, this wasn't all it was portrayed to be. In fact, the person never had connections to Al-Qaeda. He never was a real terrorist were it not for the FBI providing him with the means. This has allowed the FBI to portray the threat of Islamic terrorism in the United States as much greater than it is through a rather complicit media delivering that message.
How corrupt has D.C. become? Professor Clower, what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, I want to be careful about the word corrupt in the sense that there is a criminal definition of corruption, and then there is a maybe a more pernicious operational definition that would include self-serving behavior at the expense of the people you're supposed to represent. So in terms of that, we have legal agencies that have as part of their charges to look for official corruption, and we see from time to time that somebody will do something so over the top, like stashing bundles of cash in a freezer or something or another and getting caught. You know, that kind of thing happens. The system, though, is becoming more corrupt in the sense that the influence of the lobbyists that both of myself and Professor Hendricks have spoken about, that they are allowed to distort rational, sometimes economic decisions and even social decisions through influence, and it is the system itself that's become corrupt, in part because of just the sheer amount of money that it takes now to get elected. Once you get elected, there is probably a quite personally rational activity that you want to get reelected. And that for the people in the House of Representatives, that is a continuous cycle. You are never not campaigning. And if you are campaigning, you're having to spend money, and that money that is required is increasingly large, and it's very difficult even for the most saintly of politicians to be able to say, I am going to take your money and not at all let you influence me on how I might vote on an issue.
Okay. Your thoughts, Professor Hendricks?
I agree that, you know, that is fundamentally the issue. We have a, let's say, a corrupting system in place. It makes it indeed necessary. You literally have to sell yourself to get to the top. You know, we used to, I remember when I was much younger, we used to, of course, make fun of the Soviet system as one, you know, anybody that actually rises to the top of that must have sold themselves over and over given their party structure. Unfortunately, our system works about the same way. There's very few people that can rise to the top without doing that. So we have a corrupting system more than just a corrupt system. Of course, a corrupting system creates quite a bit of corruption in terms of, yes, people that, you know, should be representing the overall population and the general long-term well-being of the American population. Instead are working most of the time for very specific groups, such as the financial industry. You know, and again, it's the fact that this is such a corrupting system, it happens to both parties, that there really isn't a whole lot of difference between the two parties, even though, you know, they try on the surface to appear quite different and make it look like we have this vibrant democracy when, in fact, you know, when it comes to really substantive issues, certainly economic issues, I don't see much difference at all. They tend to support.
And let me jump in and just say that from a fiscal perspective, if you just look at the data, you could not examine the data and make any kind of a prediction on which party was in control.
I think that's pretty correct. And specifically the special interest legislation, you know, that came across both parties as far as favoring the financial industry, the pharmaceutical industry, my goodness, the defense industry, talk about, you know, I haven't seen much difference there between parties at all. So, you know, life just goes on, and we continue on these dismal trends to some extent.
You know, one of the things is, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Mr. Clark.
Well, one of the things that becomes very interesting, and that is we see some of these efforts from time to time, political efforts that are meant to shift some of the debate. So, for example, the Grover Norquist organization, where he has gotten many Republicans to sign a no tax increase pledge. And I would argue to you that the gentleman, you know, might have a noble thought there, but it takes the absolute wrong approach, because what you're doing is telling somebody that, well, you can't get more income, you're not going to try to get more income, but you possess an absolutely unlimited American Express Black Card to spend everything you might want to spend. You're allowed to spend more than you bring in. So our problem has been, in many cases, we can get all sorts of philosophical difference of one party to the next about exactly what you spend it on, but the fundamental problem that the federal government right now is exerting upon us socially and financially is the debt and the fact that we have been spending more than we're bringing in from a federal standpoint for years now, and it's going to take a long time to correct this situation.
Okay. So what I was going to say is, so Americans have been fooled into believing that these political parties are fighting about ideology when it's all about personal wealth, right? Because they benefit from this. Am I wrong about that? when you've got your lobbyists and you've got different, you know, officials trying to stay in office, it's a corruptive system, then it all kind of boils down to big government, big personal wealth, right?
Well, to the extent that to gain political power, you need to sell yourself. The objective of gaining political power seems to be more the ability to sell yourself. You know, the party in power gets perhaps more contributions than the party out of power. You know, the party in power gets to have chairs of all the committees in the House or the Senate, and of course those people get phenomenal amounts of contributions because they have a lot of power that can be sold in the market, if you will, the political market. And the system just, you know, cascades into ever higher levels of distortion. And yes, it shows up, you know, in part with too much expenditure, not enough taxation. Again, that's what the special interest wants. Nobody's out there lobbying saying, tax me more. But, of course, those many times the same groups are out there lobbying saying, give me more. So you have this system highly biased toward spending more and taxing less. Something's got to give eventually, obviously, as you say. That's just not a sustainable business plan here for our country.
I mean, but look at – I'm going to pick on – I know he's picked on a lot, but, I mean, look at Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader. He has several family members that are lobbyists for a number of companies. He's got a son that's lobbied on behalf of several groups that, if I'm right, I mean, I could be wrong about this, that has secured millions, I think over $50 million in earmark. I mean, how is that not corrupt? You know what I mean? It's crazy, the system that's there. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong about it, but that's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, he's got another son, I think, that they say that's working on a $5 billion venture with the Chinese to develop some sort of an energy project. And, I mean, they're lobbyists. So, I mean, they're benefiting from that. That's personal wealth, is it not?
It's sure. Not personal wealth necessarily to Leader Reid, but your point is well made. And you almost, though, have to go back to the fact that, you know, that does have every appearance of some level of corruption, and yet the good people of Nevada continue to reelect Mr. Reid.
Right. Yeah. I see your point. Right.
So I mean, we have the ability to fix that part of the problem. We just, as a society, show an unwillingness to want to engage in the information gathering and to be bothered enough to quit watching The Bachelor long enough to pay attention to such things.
Right.
Yeah,
point.
I agree. You know, the interesting question is, you know, what do we do about it? Is our system, you know, beyond help at this point? Is it simply a runaway train that is very difficult to stop? And it seems to be. I mean, you get over the years, you know, Supreme Court justices who think it's fine that a corporation is a human being with eternal life, when in fact a corporation is created by the government. It is not a natural human being by any means. And we would certainly have the means to tell them what they can and cannot do, yet we have a court system that says we can't. And so, yeah, you get decisions like that, and you're very easily persuaded that there's nothing we can do to stop this thing anymore. It's just going to go from bad to worse. On the other hand, you know, voters could wake up. That would be nice. But, you know, again, how do you reverse this process is an extreme.
A couple of things that get real interesting in that, you know, so one of the things we haven't said the word, but one of the things that could come up out of this is, gee, what about term limits? And yet the party that calls themselves as conservative, and I mean, there's many different types of conservatism, but the conservatives say, no, we are against that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an intrusion on the person. Of course, I personally think that, you know, you can say, I'm going to choose a career as a politician, and it's quite all right for me to say back to you, okay, that's a public service thing. It's not the same thing as telling you that you can, you know, go out and pursue life, liberty, and happiness.
The term limits issue is interesting. We have had an experience here in Nebraska that is, I think, worth just mentioning here very briefly. We went to term limits here in Nebraska for our legislature. It did not work out at all, as everyone had hoped, because what happened is we lost some relatively good, experienced politicians that had some degree of independence and replaced them by complete novices that were largely funded and bought from the start. So you have to be careful with this term limit business. You tend to get continually very inexperienced people, or you get new candidates that are basically pushed forward by special interests to run for this office, given a lot of money, and because the election is between people that no one knows, the one best funded gets in. And so you start right away with a well-funded politician. We lost a very dear politician here to the term limits, Ernie Chambers. I don't know if you're familiar at all with him. He's quite a character here. He's the only black in the legislature, or was the only black in the legislature. Incredibly independent, did wonderful work. He, of course, was kicked out and replaced by someone who was bought from day one and was a disaster. Luckily, Ernie come back 4 years later and ran for office again and is back in. He could have just continued there. So we've had a very mixed experience with the term limits. It has not, I don't think, worked out very well at all in terms of getting independent politicians in office. Remember, a politician that's in office for a while, if they're good, can actually build up a certain amount of independence. Not that that invariably happens. We've seen many cases to the contrary. But you have to be very careful with, where did the new candidates come from? Who are they? And does money play a role in those? And we found in Nebraska that money plays an even bigger role in those because you're fighting among unknowns where money is everything, mm-hmm. as opposed to any record or experience that can be used to, influence voters.
Well, before we have to take our next break, you guys may have answered this already, but I wanted to get in here and ask you, how is it that Washington, D.C. has managed to have the largest per capita income in the United States while I think one out of six Americans still struggle? Is that due to the corruption of the system or what?
Well, I would argue that part of that is could be the corruption of the system or endemic corruption in the system. That's maybe part of it. But the other, perhaps larger part of it right now, is that, as you noted in the introduction, the federal government is a very, very large employer, and with few exceptions, that's very secure employment. Mm-hmm. And the salary ranges are usually pretty good. I mean, it may be, still a little under some comparable private sector jobs, but in terms of the average working person, middle income earner, a federal government job is pretty darn well paying. The benefits programs are quite good, and of course, it is one of the most secure jobs that you can have out there. So it's one that over time that would be an indicator that you would expect there to be some accumulated income potential because you have a very long-term employees in the federal government who have gotten step increases over the years and make pretty good money.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
To add to that quickly, I think we still have to look at the power structure and the political system as well to explain that exceptionally high per capita mm-hmm. income. Because government per se should not, even though, again, I fully agree, these are more secure jobs in many cases, and that's quite correct. But still, to explain that exceptionally high income, I think part of that definitely does come back to the potential gains from using the government, from redistributing through government, from influencing government, that simply the returns to that are extremely high to special interests, and they're willing to pay a lot of money to hire a lot of very talented people. Again, we may not like what these people do, but they are generally well-paid, highly educated, professionals who engage in this lobbying activity, and that definitely, you know, raises Washington income. I think that's a huge factor in explaining the difference. I don't see just with government that income on average should be that much higher in Washington, yet we see it substantially higher, and that is that, in a sense, corruption or semi-corruption or lobbying, whatever you want to call it, an activity that dominates there.
Okay. We'll be right back after this break.
You say that the media narrative itself seems to be turning against the FBI.
Absolutely. Foreign Policy magazine had a blog item a few months ago that said, how many idiot jihadis can the FBI fool? What also has happened is these cases have come to trial in many cities, and the media are now seeing that these were people that were empowered by FBI informants, and that left to their own devices, the evidence suggested they weren't going to do anything.
Are we in the end safer because we've got $3 billion per year going towards counterterrorism that yields some clown defendants, or is it all a mirage?
I think it's both. They're creating an environment where perhaps a real terrorist would begin to question everyone he's collaborating with. He'd begin to think, well, is that person a government agent? Is that person an informant? That is perhaps a beneficial effect of these sting operations in the counterterrorism mission. But the mirage effect is that the people that are ultimately charged with terrorism, left to their own devices, they would have continued to be a Walmart stalker. In one case, the target of the sting tells the informant who's providing him with all the capability, if it wasn't for you, I probably would have just ended up stabbing someone with a steak knife. I can also say, and the data shows this, that as the FBI has pursued Islamic terrorism with such a singular focus, they've lost focus on other threats, such as the sovereign citizen movement and the white supremacist movement, who, since 9/11, have actually killed more people than Islamic terrorists.
All right, Trevor. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Trevor Aronson is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism.
All right. How do we stop this system of manipulation in D.C., or can we?
One thing, I think you go back, and I'm sorry if I'm seeming to kind of harp on one issue, but we have largely a disengaged electorate. And to me, that is the fundamental area. Term limits, you know, could be successful, of course, and unfortunately, you know, you can throw the baby out with the bathwater sometimes. You have other issues of maybe of restructuring laws that are meant to be tighter about the legal definition of corruption. But it's a matter of how do we hold our elected officials accountable for their actions. If we were to unelect a few people that had the appearance of being influenced overly so by lobbyists, then very quickly I would expect behavior to change among the politicians because they do want to be in that position of power. You know, just an example, and not really to pick on Senator Reid, but, you know, sometimes you when there's a lot of material there, you take advantage of it. But last weekend, he was on the news media talking about claiming that they were making, that the government plans, that the Democrat plan had built in $2.6 trillion of cuts over 10 years, and that was completely incorrect. And he repeated it multiple times. So it wasn't a slip of the tongue. It's one, you know, that their $2.6 million comes from a combination of tax increases and cuts and all of this. But we don't call our politicians when they make these blatant statements like this.
Okay. Professor Hendrick?
Well, again, this is the tough question. It is, as I said, often you get the look of a system that's kind of like a runaway train. And, you know, the problem with this, you know, that I see is that, yes, the voter is disengaged, increasingly so. I find it very, very disturbing at a university where most of your students are disengaged. You know, if young people at the university level can't be motivated to take an interest in their future, their society, it's of course, you know, I find that very, very discouraging. And I can rant in front of class on this on occasion and try to wake people up. But it's so where do we go? You know, I think we have to look, for one thing, at how we finance elections has to be changed. This idea that this is, you know, anyone can spend any amount from any source.
We've about run out of time, Professor Hendricks and Professor Clower. I apologize about that. I thank you both for joining us today. I hope you guys will tune in with us on February 23rd when we will jump back into the arena of the church and talk about the mythologies of Jesus Christ. Until next time, be prayerful, be wise, be adaptable. Thank you both for joining us today. Have a good week.
Okay, thanks for having us.
It is. No subject is taboo. If it's brought to the table, you bet we cover it. No more lies, no more deception. You have a right to know. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.